Nuclear reactors in a war zone. The Russian invasion of Ukraine has focused attention on the fact that, with 15 nuclear power reactors on the ground, Ukraine could be considered to have 15 dirty bombs pre-deployed in that country, just waiting to be set off by Russian missiles or any one of a range of human mistakes or military actions, all to devastating effect. Why has no one thought of this as an ongoing vulnerability posed by nuclear reactors? But then you hear a genuine expert who has been covering nuclear issues for decades, and as regards the dangers in Ukraine, he tells you.
In addition to the concern about all the atrocities that this conflict could create, you have to be concerned about the additional dimension of having these nuclear power plants in a theater of war. Because although many analysts over the decades have raised the issue of what do you do if you do find a nuclear power plant is in the middle of an armed conflict, it's just one of a long list of issues that the nuclear industry and regulators and the international community have kind of swept under the rug.
Well, when Edwin Lyman, Director of Nuclear Power Safety with the Union of Concerned Scientists, tells you that this major nuclear vulnerability has been ignored for decades by other so-called nuclear industry experts, much to the detriment of Ukraine and who knows how many other locations in the future. You get to see how dangerous and all-encompassing is that seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an update on the nuclear situation in Ukraine with Edwin Lyman. He is Director of Nuclear Power Safety with the Union of Concerned Scientists. We discuss the ongoing issues at the 6-reactor Zaporizhzhia site in Ukraine and Russia's threats against yet another nuclear site in that country. We will also have nuclear news from around the world. Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, focusing on Greenpeace's examination of radiation levels at Chernobyl, in contrast to what the International Atomic Energy Agency has discovered, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and more honest nuclear information than Joni Mitchell sang about at the Newport Folk Festival, and aren't we glad of it? All of this will be coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 26, 2022, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with Ukraine, where there are a number of reports piling up to show exactly how dangerous the situation there is looking. Reports came out of the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant in South Ukraine around July 18 that Russia was using the plant site to launch missiles. CNN is now reporting that 9 Russian soldiers are in a nearby hospital, with 1 in intensive care and at least 3 dead. Other reports do not make it clear whether the injured and dead are Ukrainian plant staff that were injured in an attack or injured Russian soldiers. More than 500 Russian soldiers seized the plant in early March and turned it into a military garrison, moving Russian Rosatom staff into an underground bunker turned command center. The final set of connections to on-site cameras and data feeds at the plant for the International Atomic Energy Agency were cut in early July. Workers at the plant have reported that at least 40 of the plant's 11,000 workers have been kidnapped and held for ransom by Russian troops. Ukrainian plant workers accused by the Russian occupiers of being spies have been beaten, tortured, and starved. The IAEA has been unable to send inspectors to the plant, and workers have been unable to bring in equipment and supplies to operate the plant. They've missed the spring refueling and maintenance window, and these problems drastically increase the risk of a mechanical or system failure at the plant. Due to the conditions created by the Russian occupation of the 6 nuclear reactor Zaporizhzhia site, any response to an incident would be impossible. The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has said recent reports about the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant indicate an increasingly alarming situation there, and said, during a conflict of this nature, a nuclear facility can be damaged unintentionally. It must be avoided at all costs. A Greenpeace survey and investigation inside the Chernobyl exclusion zone has challenged the IAEA on the radiation levels that they reported. Greenpeace found radiation levels in areas where Russian military operations occurred that classifies it as nuclear waste and is at least 3 times higher in radiation than the estimation by the IAEA that they announced in April of this year. At that time, the IAEA provided very limited data with assurances that radiation levels were quote-unquote normal and not a major environmental or public safety issue. We'll have much more about Greenpeace during this week's featured interview and the nuclear hot seat hot story. In further international news, the heat wave in Europe is having nuclear impacts as 2 Belgian nuclear reactors have cut production because of heat. Production at the Doel 1 and Doel 2 nuclear reactors have been more than halved because the cooling water that serves them is too hot to cool them because of the heat wave. In France, wildfires have been raging near the nuclear power plant in Bernilas. The EDF site is being decommissioned, but there's still a spent fuel pool there, and the fire has been raging out of control. But these climate-related nuclear problems are not getting the attention of those who are hell-bent for leather to build new nukes. In the UK, the government has approved construction of Sizewell C, a 2-reactor nuclear power plant that will be built in Suffolk in southeast England. The $20 billion project, at least that's the current estimate, and nuclear always comes in over schedule and over budget, will be mainly funded by French energy supplier EDF, which has just been nationalized, so we don't know how that's going to impact the deal. An independent planning inspectorate, which had examined the project for nearly 2 years, advised against the construction unless issues around water supply, there's not enough water in the area for the completed plant, and wildlife habitats were resolved. But on July 20th, Business Secretary Kwasi Kwarteng overrode the recommendations and confirmed development consent. At least consent by government, not the local community. And Poland's National Atomic Energy Agency has received applications to build 2 small modular nuclear reactors, despite the fact that they don't exist yet. And we'll have a link to an article, How Chernobyl Made Welsh Sheep Radioactive and Paralyzed Some Farms for 26 Years. The blast created deadly radioactive fallout 400 times larger than the Hiroshima bomb, and dangerous radioactive clouds were blown across Europe in the days following the disaster, where heavy rain then washed the radioactive decay onto fields in the UK. This was then absorbed by plants and went on to contaminate sheep that grazed on the land, forcing the Welsh government to place nearly 10,000 farms and 4 million sheep under government restrictions. Lots more to this article, and we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 579. Here in the U.S., a large number of problems at nuclear power plants have been showing up in recent weeks. The Wolf Creek nuclear plant in Kansas automatically scrammed at 100% power on July 20th. That's the equivalent of going 100 miles an hour down the freeway and then slamming on the brakes. It's not good for the motor. This happened after a feed water transient led to decreasing water level in a steam generator. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission found 2 violations at the Robinson nuclear plant in South Carolina after two coolant pump leaks occurred due to inadequate maintenance procedures. One resulted in a shutdown in October 2021, and the other leaked between 10 and 30 gallons of boric acid. The NRC also found two cybersecurity violations at the Peach Bottom nuclear plant in Pennsylvania. These were associated with issues of documentation and with collection and evaluation of operating experience data. All of those items, by the way, came from the tweet feed of Edwin Lyman of the Union of Concerned Scientists, who you'll be hearing from during the featured interview today. In North St. Louis, torrential rains and massive flooding are creating pathways for Manhattan Project legacy radioactive waste to move and spread into people's yards, in ground gardens, homes, and basements. This information is not coming from the government, but from members of Just Moms STL, the group that has been so active in trying to get a cleanup of the waste sites. We hope to have more on this story next week. And we'll have a link to an article on how Boeing created a nature preserve that may also preserve pollution, much of it being radioactive pollution. This is about the Santa Susana Field Lab, located in Simi Valley, only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles. That's where Boeing and dozens of other companies have granted, quote, conservation easements on some of the most contaminated land in the U.S. so that the companies can save millions in cleanups with these deals, arguing that no one will ever live there. However, the Santa Susana Field Lab, which was site of nuclear meltdowns and nuclear radiation pits in the early 50s and 60s, is surrounded by residential neighborhoods. And this regulatory equivalent of a get-out-of-jail-free card is not being accepted, especially by the groups Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab and Physicians for Social Responsibility. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act has provided restitution to over 39,000 people who were unknowing, unwilling, and previously uncompensated victims of the Cold War because of radiation exposure from the Trinity test site in New Mexico and the atmospheric testing at the Nevada test site. But many exposed communities are still excluded, and they have spent decades fighting for justice. RECA, shorthand for the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, is a bipartisan program established in 1990 that provides partial restitution for the devastating health impacts of radiation exposure from U.S. nuclear weapons testing and production. Though RECA has been temporarily extended until 2024, it is still highly flawed, and many exposed communities have never been eligible for coverage. We're going to have a link to the website expandreca.org so that you can learn more about this. We'll also link to a Des Moines Register article. It's an opinion piece. Mid-America shouldn't waste money studying small nuclear reactors. Amen to that. And we'll link to the NBC News article, How Easy Is It to Get the Material to Make a Dirty Bomb? Very, according to a report by the Government Accountability Office. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, check on episode number 579. Over to Japan, where that country's Nuclear Regulatory Authority's approval for the Fukushima Daiichi radioactive pollution of the Pacific Ocean has been condemned by Greenpeace East Asia, which claims that it has no justification, is based on incomplete and limited data and flawed analysis, and violates international law. Sean Burney, a senior nuclear specialist from Greenpeace East Asia, said, "The NRI approval of the TEPCO Contaminated Water Discharge Plan is scientifically and technically flawed. It is a decision intended to support the false narrative that decommissioning the destroyed reactors at Fukushima Daiichi is making real progress. In reality, the contaminated water plan is a symptom of the wider crisis that the current decommissioning plan is doomed. The discharges into the Pacific will not solve any problems, but will create many more." Friends of the Earth Japan has issued a comparable statement with specific talking points, and we will link to it on our website. The one loophole that could derail this entire plan is that TEPCO cannot proceed until they obtain the consent of local authorities. So it's not a done deal. And in a story that's too evil to be considered numbnuts, Russian radiologist Mikhail Balanov is the main author of a report released in March of last year stating that the nuclear accident at Fukushima, quote, led to no adverse documented public health effects that were directly attributable to radiation exposure from the accident, and continued, regarding an increase in new thyroid cancer cases among local children, that was judged to be the result of extensive ultrasensitive screening. Bolanov was science secretary of the UN Chernobyl Forum, which was taken down by Allison Katz of Independent WHO in our interview in Nuclear Hot Seat number 571 from May 31st. She reveals how UNSCEAR, the IAEA, and the World Health Organization all downplayed the deaths and health impact of the Chernobyl disaster. And now for more nuclear boneheadedness.
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Numb nuts out a week.
With temperatures in northeast Japan hovering in the 90s, it's no surprise that people want to cool down. And what better way to do so than to take a dip at a nearby swimming beach? Except maybe not. The Iwasawa Swimming Beach in the town of Naraha is in Fukushima Prefecture, within 25 kilometers or 15 miles of the remains of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant disaster. The beach, which is in the exclusion zone from Fukushima, was just opened for the first time since March of 2011 on July 16. It's the first bathing resort to reopen in areas once covered by evacuation orders. There's still radioactive water that is leaking into the Pacific Ocean from Fukushima Daiichi, and this says nothing about the planned release of over 1 million tons of radioactive water that is planned to start next summer. So is it safer to deal with the hot weather or to deal with the potentially hot water? It's a good question with no definitive answer, and that's why whoever decided to open this Fukushima beach back up to the public, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, Numb Nuts of the Week.
We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, nuclear war is not survivable. No matter what the nuclear industry and its toadies in politics and government bureaucracy try to convince us. And unfortunately, nuclear is not going away by itself. Not the weapons, reactors, radioactive waste, uranium mining tailings, contaminations, and risks that we already face. So it is important that we understand what's there, what we're up against, and what steps we can take to fight against industry expansion and get them to clean up the mess they've already created. But as those of us who oppose nuclear know, we face an organized, relentless, brutally well-funded publicity campaign that makes it hard to get saner voices heard. That's why Nuclear Hot Seat is here. We're dedicated to giving you the nuclear stories and issues with context and continuity, and we offer insights and tools to fight back against this forever contamination of our precious planet. But we need your help to keep doing this important work. In honor of our 11th anniversary just a few weeks back, how about sending in a donation of $11? Or you can send us $5, the same as a cup of coffee and a nice tip here in the U.S. You can do this as a one-time donation or monthly recurring support. Or you can just send more and get it over with. You'll be helping to keep Nuclear Hot Seat up and running to provide you with cutting-edge information on what the nuclear industry is doing and steps we can take to oppose them and protect ourselves. It's easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, and help us with a donation of any amount, one time only or recurring. Do what you can now, and know that however much you can help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Edwin Lyman is a physicist and Director of Nuclear Power Safety for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He specializes in nuclear proliferation, nuclear terrorism, and nuclear power safety. Lyman has published extensively in journals and magazines, testified before Congress, and advised governmental groups. He's also been cited in news stories in most major media and has been for decades. We spoke with Ed Lyman on Friday, July 22nd, 2022. Edwin Lyman, thank you so much for joining us this morning on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
For those who may not be familiar with you and your work, give us a little bit of background.
Sure. Well, I'm currently director of nuclear power safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I work in Washington, D.C. UCS is an organization that was founded more than 50 years ago to work on public policy issues that intersect with science and technology, looking at questions of war and peace originally and expanding to encompass clean energy, climate change, clean vehicles, food and the environment, and scientific integrities. But one of the first issues that it started examining when it was founded was the safety of nuclear power plants. And in the 1960s, there was a lot of enthusiasm about the growth of nuclear power and a lot of concern that the Atomic Energy Commission was not an independent regulator that was looking out for the interests of the public when it was planning on expanding nuclear power in the country. So that was one of the first topics that UCS worked on, and we're still doing it more than 50 years later, because the name of the regulator may have changed. It's now the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but some of the same problems still persist.
And do you focus primarily on United States issues, or do you look internationally?
My focus is primarily the United States, because it's where we probably have the most ability to influence things, but we do keep an eye on the situation around the world. And when circumstances warrant, we try to get involved and be helpful, at least in collecting and distributing relevant information.
When Russia began the invasion of Ukraine on February 24, what was your first nuclear concern?
Well, the war in Ukraine is really the first modern conflict in a country with nuclear power reactors. And Ukraine has 15 operating reactors at four different sites, in addition to, of course, the site of the Chernobyl disaster, which doesn't have any operating reactors anymore, but still is heavily contaminated and has a lot of radioactive material on site. So in addition to the concern about all the atrocities that this conflict could create, you have to be concerned about the additional dimension of having these nuclear power plants in a theory of war, because although many analysts over the decades have raised the issue of what do you do if you do find a nuclear power plant is in the middle of an armed conflict, it's just one of the issues, one of a long list of issues that the nuclear industry and regulators and the international community have kind of swept under the rug. You know, until it happens, they're not going to worry about it. And so finally, there was a situation where it was time to worry about it. And because there hadn't been enough attention to the ramifications among the authorities, they were caught unprepared in trying to cope with the situation. The potential is, of course, that a nuclear power plant could be subject to military bombardment, and nuclear power plants are designed to withstand certain types of events, but not others. And although they may, depending on the design and the age of the plant and other factors, may have some inherent ability to withstand some level of military bombardment, they weren't designed to do that. And there's going to be a limit, and no one really knows what that limit is. But every plant has vulnerabilities, and depending on the type of assault it's under, nuclear safety could be challenged.
Nuclear safety has definitely been challenged at the Zaporizhzhia site in the southeastern part of Ukraine. This is the largest nuclear facility in Europe. It is a six-reactor complex. Two of the reactors are still operating, but of course there are spent fuel pools there. And Russia has held the facility since March 4th. What are some of the strains that the site has been under that speak to those vulnerabilities you just mentioned?
When that facility, the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant, came under attack by Russian forces around March 4th of this year, there was, by all accounts and also video, a sustained artillery bombardment of the site. As a result, a fire was ignited in a building. No one was sure at first what was burning. It became clear that it was an administration building. It wasn't actually one of the facilities containing nuclear material. It wasn't one of the reactors. But anytime you have a fire at a nuclear power plant, that is a concern, because if it propagates, nuclear power plants are vulnerable to fire in ways which are not usually fully accounted for. Fire could disrupt electrical systems that are needed to control the cooling systems, make sure the reactors and the spent nuclear fuel are kept at a safe temperature. And if you disrupt those electrical systems and the control systems, you could have a common cause failure across a number of different safety systems at different parts of the plant. So having a fire, an uncontrolled fire at a nuclear power plant, is a very dangerous situation. This was compounded by the fact that because there was an active military operation, that off-site firefighters were not allowed for some period of time to access the site. And apparently that was part of the response plan. If you do have a fire at that plant, that off-site responders were supposed to play a role. And if they couldn't get there, it's not clear that the resources on-site were adequate to be able to fight the fire. So there's a lot of concern about that. The Russians did take possession of the site and have essentially established forcible control over it. The personnel working at the plant, thousands and thousands of personnel, are Ukrainian primarily, and they continue to work, but they are working under duress and in the circumstances of occupation by a hated enemy. And that doesn't lead to the kind of environment that you would hope to have at a nuclear power plant.
There have also been reports that the staff has been subject to torture, to kidnapping, to extortion of their families for payments, where they've actually had to go and crowdfund the money to be able to get their loved ones off the hook while still remaining inside the nuclear reactor. What does that kind of human environment do to the safety of the plant?
Yes, well, one problem is there are a lot of reports coming out, and it's very hard to parse, you know, from where we sit, what's, you know, how much veracity can be attributed to some of these reports. But it's pretty clear where there's smoke, there's fire, you know, to use a metaphor. And so it's pretty clear that, you know, no matter what the details are, you do have a condition where that Ukrainian staff is working under the direction and military control of this foreign power. And to the extent that some of these stories are true, that there are these unusual type of pressure that's being applied, perhaps because some critical personnel are not compliant and they're being coerced into complying, that is only increasing the tension level. And optimally, you want to have staff running a nuclear power plant who are not under undue stress, who are functioning well psychologically or well oriented, and certainly have sufficient rest. And it's just not clear at all that those conditions are present. In fact, it's pretty obvious that they aren't, many of the staff. So the fact that there are still three operating nuclear power plants, and of course, all the spent nuclear fuel at a pool at each reactor, in addition to a separate dry cast storage facility, just that enormous amount of radioactive material that the staff needs to ensure the safety of, it's got to be concerned that you do not have that critical human element of a staff that is functioning well.
On July 5th, The Wall Street Journal published an article with the headline, "Russian Army Turns Ukraine's Largest Nuclear Plant into a Military Base. Landmines and missile launchers are deployed at Zaporizhzhia as cameras and instruments go dark and workers are held for ransom."
Yes, this is the latest development. You know, the war isn't going well for Russia in a number of different respects. Recently, Ukraine reportedly has had success using drones and other means to disrupt Russian artillery. And as a result, it appears, if these stories are true, that Russia is using the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant as a forward operating base and has moved military equipment, ammunition, and weapons into the plant and is storing it there, essentially using the nuclear plant as a shield with the expectation that Ukrainians are not going to try to bomb their own nuclear power plant. And this is a abhorrent use of this facility that, again, it's not clear that the nuclear community ever imagined that commercial nuclear power plants would be put into this kind of position. So you have them being used as shields to protect military equipment and rocket launchers and artillery launchers that are being used as safe havens to attack the nearby population. And the Ukrainians are virtually powerless to fight back because of the location of some of this equipment. Reportedly, some of it is being stored within the turbine building of one of the reactors. That is the system that's used to convert radioactive steam into electricity. So if that's true, they're actually storing the equipment within the confines of one of the nuclear reactors itself.
Does it appear that Russia had this as an intentional tactic and strategy going into the war, or is this something that has been developed as they went along and saw the opportunity?
You know, it's hard to speculate about their intentions or how well thought out any of this campaign was and how much of it is rejiggered on the fly. Certainly, it was clear from the beginning that the Chernobyl plant would be of interest to the Russian invasion, partly because of its location near the closest border access to Kyiv, was through the exclusion zone of Chernobyl. So it wasn't a surprise that Russia immediately seized that location. Just logically, nuclear power plants that supply half the electricity of Ukraine are strategic targets. And certainly, if its objective is to dominate and control another country forcibly, taking control of the nuclear power plants, like other critical infrastructure, would seem to be critical. So it's not a surprise that they invaded. I do think that this development of using them as shields, essentially leveraging the danger of attacking a nuclear power plant against the ability to harbor these weapons and render the Ukrainians powerless to attack, that may not have been explicitly a strategy that the Russians considered, but who knows?
You mentioned Chernobyl, and that was the first place that Russia went after a nuclear site. They took it over on March 4th, and when they were there, they dug trenches in the highly radioactive Red Forest section of the exclusion zone. They placed landmines, and they were moving in missiles and weaponry to make it a military base, not unlike what they've accomplished with Zaporizhzhia. But in less than a month, they abandoned the effort and got out. Now, at that time, there were rumors that there was radiation sickness, that there were perhaps deaths. Again, we don't know specifically, but do you think that there was a change in plans because they had underestimated the impact? Were they ignorant of it, or did they just not take it into consideration? Why this sudden reversal at Chernobyl?
Yes, again, I don't want to speculate. I haven't seen any evidence that some of those more dramatic stories of what happened to the soldiers were validated. In fact, they ran counter to my own understanding of the actual level of radioactivity at Chernobyl. It takes an awfully high rate of ionizing radiation exposure to see the kinds of effects that were being reported. And even though there are these locations in the exclusion zone with highly radioactive soil, there's a lot of information about surveys that have been done and just didn't seem plausible that you would have large numbers of troops with acute radiation sickness. I don't think that they abandoned Chernobyl because necessarily the radiological hazard. They were obviously under a lot of international pressure because of the concern of what was going on at Chernobyl. And it may not have seemed to be tenable in the long term for the Russians to take over the management of the site. First of all, it's a vast site, and it just may not have been an objective anymore that they needed. Once they recalibrated their strategy, decided to focus on the south and the east of the country rather than trying to take Kyiv, I think was really part of that. But my understanding is Greenpeace, with the cooperation of the Ukrainian government, has just returned from doing radiological surveys, and I haven't actually seen the results of that.
That's what I wanted to get into next, because on April 28th, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, issued a statement that following Russian occupation of Chernobyl, the increased radiation levels, quote, did not pose a great danger to the environment or people. And in essence, the IAEA gave the site an all clear. But there was an international team of independent radiation experts led by Greenpeace Germany that just recently examined the Russian positions in Chernobyl for radioactive contamination. And just 2 days ago, they issued their results that it had found radiation levels in areas where the Russians were to be at least three times higher than the estimation given by the IAEA. What is your understanding of these results, and what are the implications of this finding?
Well, even three times higher is still not anywhere near the kind of dose rates that would lead to acute radiation syndrome. You're still, you'd need probably hundreds of times higher. So I still don't think that, I think it's a bit of a red herring. What was a concern is that you had that it's a radiologically controlled area that the Russians entered without due concern or observing any of the normal protocols for occupants of a radiologically controlled area. So they violated international norms. They stirred up radioactive dust with their vehicles and heavy machinery. And that was what most people believe was responsible for the increased dose rates, just mobilizing some of that radioactive dust. And whether or not it had major health impact or not, it was definitely a violation of norms and how you would observe the protocols in a radiologically controlled area. So putting aside whether, you know, how bad it was certainly another violation of international norms that could be added to the Russian tally of what's the atrocities going on in Ukraine.
Is there any importance that deserves to be attached to the fact that the IAEA levels, the ones that they reported, are different than the ones that were just discovered?
Yeah, I'd have to look at it. Again, I don't think a factor of three is that meaningful, given the wide variation in dose rates from one point to another. So again, I'd be looking for something like a factor of 100 that would really make me concerned. So, you know, the IAEA, although in a lot of respects, they've tended to underplay the radiological health implications of nuclear power plant accidents, as we know, I don't think in this case they were looking to underestimate what the Russians were doing. So I don't think there's any real motivation there for them to dissemble or to give false information. I think this is probably just the scope of the surveys and other experimental aspects that led to this difference. But I haven't looked at the data yet, so I'm just speculating.
Certainly there will continue to be more speculation about what those findings are and exactly what they mean. Moving on, there has been a report that should Russia be forced to withdraw from Ukraine, it has threatened to launch a missile at the Khmelnytskaya nuclear reactors in the northwest part of the country. This apparently came from one of the Russian generals. The rationale for planning a bombing there being that it's closer to Europe, further from Russia, and so any radiation release and damage it would inflict would impact greatest in the European Union and in NATO countries. How credible do you find this story?
I actually didn't hear that. You know, while I wouldn't underestimate the capability of the Russians to do stupid things and dangerous things in Ukraine, I don't see any military advantage it would gain for them to sabotage a nuclear power plant. I mean, if their objective is to occupy all of Ukraine, incorporate into Russia, then I just don't see why they would take an asset like a nuclear power plant, deliberately turn into a massive liability and environmental cleanup issue and public health concern. I'm skeptical that that's a rational objective, but again, Russia may not always be behaving rationally in this particular circumstance.
The takeover of a nuclear power plant in a war zone is unprecedented, and we're still learning the dangers as they roll out. Is this a harbinger of the future for any country that either has or is considering obtaining nuclear reactors?
Well, I can't say it's a harbinger, but it certainly should serve as a warning sign and give pause to some of the deployment plans that the nuclear industry is considering. And one trend which I find increasingly worrisome is this notion that the future of nuclear power is actually in small modular reactors and micro reactors, these tiny, well, small, not always so small, but smaller than current generation reactors that can be deployed in a distributed fashion rather than concentrating them into a small number of sites like they are today. You can place them close to population centers, you can use them to power industrial facilities, you can send them to remote locations. In fact, Russia has a couple of examples of this, but the industry is, for whatever reason, seeing this as their future, is essentially putting smaller reactors closer to populations with fewer levels of protection. And that, I think, doesn't make sense in any respect, but certainly you need to consider, again, this possibility that you may have any country, no matter how stable, over the course of the lifetime of a nuclear power plant, many decades, could evolve politically into a situation where those plants are now targets or convenient safe havens for hostile military operations, or they could be used to hold hostage the nearby communities like we're seeing. So it just seems the industry really needs to use this as a warning and to put more thought into plans for how and where you deploy nuclear power plants if they're going to be deployed.
With the focus of the nuclear industry being on proliferation of its on-the-ground reactors, be they small modular nuclear reactors or the larger ones, in one of the great counterintuitive moves one could even imagine, we just learned that Ukraine is planning to move ahead with building more nuclear reactors. Last month, EnergoAtom signed agreements to build more reactors, transition to buying all of its nuclear fuel from Sweden rather than Russia. And also there are other factors in this as well. In terms of Ukraine, does the left hand not know what the right hand is doing? Or how in the world, facing what they're facing at Zaporizhia, would they even consider doing this?
Yeah, I think that's an example of the kind of denial and tunnel vision that the nuclear industry exhibits everywhere. And it's particularly acute here, but I guess they're looking forward to a future where they don't see Russia as a threat anymore, and that may not be realistic. But we do have this dynamic where, because of, unfortunately, the way that Russia may be holding Western Europe hostage with regard to natural gas supplies, that is somehow fueling this notion that these countries need nuclear power, and somehow that would be a more independent bulwark against this kind of blackmail. So transitioning from fossil fuel dependence to nuclear power rather than to renewable energy is seen as somehow a more viable option for becoming secure. And I think, there's a lot of problems with that logic. It's hard to fathom why they would be considering these proposals now, given the threat that they're under, unless they have an overly optimistic view of how this is all going to play out.
Can you envision an exit strategy for Russia from Ukraine that would allow for the end of the war and the withdrawal of troops without triggering some further level of nuclear danger or devastation?
I'm not a military strategist, and I don't know what Russia's game plan is, but certainly I think one thing that caught the international community by surprise is the willingness of Russia to violate these norms and use what are ostensibly, you know, peaceful or civil nuclear power facilities as military bases, and the threats of nuclear blackmail that come with that deployment. I think in an optimal situation, Russia will acknowledge that the nuclear power plants in Ukraine should be neutral territory, that their integrity should be respected, that they shouldn't be misused in this manner. That's what the International Atomic Energy Agency is hoping to achieve. It has these principles or pillars of nuclear safety that believes Russia is violating in Ukraine. The international law is actually kind of ambiguous on whether nuclear power plants can be targeted or not in war. And that's something that I think will also have to be addressed. But I certainly hope that there's a peaceful resolution of this conflict as soon as possible, and it doesn't involve any escalation that involves further danger to these nuclear facilities. But if Ukraine decides it needs to retake them by force, and you start seeing combat at Zaporizhia, or if Russia advances to the other plants in the country and Ukraine realizes it has to defend them more vigorously than it defended Zaporizhia, then we're talking about another level of danger, which has got to be of concern to anybody.
Is there anything we haven't covered that you'd like to touch upon at this time?
There are these reports that Ukraine is attacking, you know, Russia has accused Ukraine of attacking Zaporizhia with drones. There's just reports today that make it appear that there was an attack, but it was outside of the plant on Russian weapons that were outside of Zaporizhia, and that Ukraine used precise drone strikes to destroy them. So it wasn't an actual attack on the plant. But again, the more vulnerable Russia feels its forces and equipment are, the more likely it may be to continue to build up Zaporizhia as a military base and a storehouse and a launching pad for attacks. That's just, again, pretty great concern going that direction.
And are there any changes that you are making to either the way you conduct yourself in your position or in your interaction with other experts around the world as we continue on with the situation in Ukraine?
I mean, I've long been concerned about the vulnerability of nuclear plants to intentional attacks, intentional accidents. The industry prides itself that nuclear power plants have a high resistance to accidents. Whether or not that's true is debatable, but it's only fairly low probability events like what we saw at Fukushima that could actually cause the kind of disaster that we saw at Fukushima. But that's, you know, assuming nature, taking the rarity of events in the natural world as for granted. But if you consider the possibility of deliberate attacks, whether it's a national military like we see in Ukraine, or it's subnational groups such as the armed, violent, right-wing extremists here in the United States, equipped with weapons of war because our government is failing to control those. We have threats here at home, which also are of great concern. The problem is that it takes money or resources to defend nuclear power plants and make sure that they are prepared to withstand an attack by a fascist group. And the industry doesn't like spending that money because they aren't really convinced that it's ever going to happen. But we do have over 90 nuclear reactors in the United States, and they are potentially vulnerable to a well-planned attack that could result in something like a Fukushima-type accident if they are not denied access to the site. So this isn't just a problem for Ukraine and a military attack. You have to worry about subnational groups that have military capabilities right here at home.
Ed Lyman, I want to thank you for taking the time today to speak with the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, and it's been a pleasure, and I appreciate the invitation.
Edwin Lyman. He is a physicist and the director of nuclear power safety at the Union of Concerned Scientists. I suggest that you sign up for his tweets, which are accessed at Nuke Safety UCS. That's NUC Safety UCS. He provides a steady stream of information on what's going wrong at nuclear reactors around the country and is a regular source for my stories here on Nuclear Hot Seat. During the interview, when we discussed the threat to the Khmelnytskyi nuclear reactors, there was not much to bolster that claim. But note that 2 days after our interview, Ukraine reported that Russia had launched four cruise missiles into the Khmelnytskyi region, and that the Ukrainian Air Force destroyed all four. No word as to the proximity of these four missiles or their trajectories to the two nuclear reactor site, or why that particular region was targeted. But it makes the threat of targeted damage to those two reactors much more credible. As for the Greenpeace results of examining the International Atomic Energy Agency's, or IAEA's, radiation report on Chernobyl after the Russians withdrew, here's another perspective from Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
The International Atomic Energy Agency is a deeply problematic entity. On the one hand, it is tasked with oversight and safety enforcement of the world's nuclear power industry. On the other hand, it is bent on promoting the use of nuclear power. Its mission statement proclaims this inherent contradiction. It reads, quote, "The IAEA works for the safe, secure, and peaceful application of nuclear science and technology, contributing to international peace and security and the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals," unquote. The IAEA was complicit in grossly downplaying the health consequences of the 1986 Chernobyl disaster, its numbers so low they were ultimately rejected even by relatively conservative sources. Now it seems the agency is guilty once again of downplaying the dangers at Chernobyl after the February occupation of that site by invading Russian forces. After Russian soldiers rolled in with heavy armored equipment, churning up radioactive topsoil, then dug trenches and camped in the exclusion zone, fears were raised about heightened levels of radioactivity in the area. The IAEA went in, conducted tests, and reassured the world that there were no concerns. But Greenpeace, sensing that the IAEA's obvious conflict of interest may be muting its alarm bells, decided to conduct some testing of its own. What the team found were radiation dose rates in some cases three times higher than those estimated by the IAEA, and also further afield than the IAEA chose to measure. Said Jan van der Putter, lead radiation specialist at Greenpeace Belgium, "We measured levels of gamma radiation inside the abandoned Russian trenches that qualified as low-level nuclear waste. Clearly, the Russian military was operating in a highly radioactive environment, but that's not what the IAEA is communicating. We can only conclude that the IAEA, for some reason, decided not to make an effort to fully investigate." Of course, van der Putter knows what that "some reason" is. An agency in the business of promoting use of nuclear power will hardly want to draw attention to its obvious black eyes. We just have to go back to Chernobyl 1986. As historian Kate Brown's in-depth research and reporting has revealed, the IAEA knew there was a significant growth in thyroid cancer among children exposed by the Chernobyl accident, but then did not acknowledge this publicly. Instead, they dismissed such findings as, quote, "hearsay and anecdotal." That's just one small example, but it's hardly surprising that we can't rely on exposure data from the IAEA in the current climate around Ukraine's nuclear power plants either. More on that in next week's Hot Story. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's Hot Story.
Thanks, Linda.
Activists, shout out.
Gender and Radiation Impact Project, or GRIP, is offering short online courses on radiation. They'll be taught this fall by Mary Olson of GRIP and Cindy Folkers of Beyond Nuclear. These two women have a combined half century of experience in helping others understand radiation and the disproportionate impact it has on women and little girls. We'll have a link up to where you can learn more about these courses at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 579. That's also where you will find a link to a press conference that was held by San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace on why the deal to shut down the Diablo Canyon nuclear reactors must be followed through on. Among the speakers are former Nuclear Regulatory Commission Commissioner Peter Bradford, Friends of the Earth's Eric Pica, seismologist Sam Blakesley, and Natural Resources Defense Council's Ralph Kavanaugh. Heavy-duty speakers, great information. Now to just get someone, are you listening, Governor Gavin Newsom? Somebody to pay attention to all of this. And it is with great sadness that we announce the passing of Terry Berry. She was a founding member of the Alliance of Nuclear Workers Advocacy Groups. Terry was a tireless advocate for the nuclear complex and uranium worker community, and she tenaciously applied her expert knowledge on behalf of the sick worker community, writing letters to federal agencies and Congress about challenges workers faced in navigating the compensation program. Her efforts led to agency attention, reforms, process changes, and substantially improved access to worker benefits. Terry Berry passed away after a long illness on July 21st, 2022. We'll have a link up to an interview we did with her from January 20th of 2015 on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 579. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 26, 2022. If you want to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's easy. Just go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down for the yellow opt-in box, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get one and only one email from us, and that will contain the link to the program and a short description of some of the show's content. You can also sign up at your favorite podcast channel if that's the way you prefer to get your podcasts. Either way, you'll make certain that you never miss another episode of Nuclear Hot Seat. So people ask me all the time, where do you get your information? A lot of the time, I get my information from you, the listeners, because you're up close and personal with whatever the nuclear story is in your area, and I rely on you to let me know. So if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send it by email. Please don't use Facebook. I lose those all the time. Send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And if you appreciate weekly verifiable news updates about nuclear issues around the world, take a moment, go to the website, and look for that modest red button. Click on it and follow the prompts. Anything you can do to help will be deeply appreciated. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2022, Libby Halevy and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as proper attribution is provided. What does that mean? You've got to mention the program, the website, me, and if you cite any of the guests, please mention their names as well. This is Libby Halevy, producer host of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as UN Secretary General Gutierrez said, nuclear weapons offer false promises of security and deterrence while guaranteeing only destruction, death, and endless brinksmanship. There you go. Couldn't be plainer. So you have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. Please, whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.